Hello and welcome to the EV Cafe Takeaway, a podcast focused on that zero emission future that we all hope for. And every week I'm joined by one of the wonderful members of the EV Cafe team. And this week I've got John Curtis, looking very Ming the Merciless, to be fair.
Gordon's alive.
I know, hello. How are you all?
We're very good. And children, for those of you that are under the age of 40, then Ming the Merciless was on the telly as John and I grew up. But there we go.
Flash Gordon.
Anyway, moving. Yes, it was. It was Flash Gordon. It was, and it was brilliant. Google it. It will amuse you for many hours
moments
to come. But anyway, more importantly than all of that, we are joined every week by the wonderful innovators, pioneers, and collaborators within our industry. And this week, it's no exception. We have the wonderful Rene Rogers, everyone.
Hey. Woo-hoo.
Welcome, Rene, CEO and founder of...
Oh, no!
That's a company, by the way.
Although people do tend to say, oh no, Renee's come in whenever I walk into a
place. You've usually got a glass of champagne in your hands, so it's never really an issue.
Very true.
Absolutely. Well, it's brilliant. Rene, listen, for those people that don't know you, I mean, ingrats one and all, tell us, what is Ono and who are you in relation to Ono, and how did it come about? Give us a little big lift speech.
Okay,
it's a very slow lift.
I am the founder of Ono, and Ono is an app and supporting software for fleet owners and drivers to help them report and manage their road traffic incidences. So over the past 12 years, I actually started by building a fleet of vehicles up from 40 cars to 500. And during that time, you can imagine I was dealing with an incident a day, which was a huge headache. And not just a headache, extremely expensive. And I thought to myself, there must be a better way of helping my drivers who were predominantly non-English speaking to report an accident at the roadside quickly and efficiently. Nothing on the market. So I thought, oh, okay, well, I need to build this myself then. And off I go. And I started this journey into the wonderful world of building a tech and software company. And I'm not that great. I'm a lot poorer, that's for sure. But it's been absolutely thrilling. And I'm so excited because this is the year we launch, and we've just finished beta testing, and we go to launch around sort of February, March time.
Rene,
fantastic.
How did you go about that? Because, you know, I'm reasonably tech savvy, but I wouldn't dream of creating an app, a program, a system to do anything, because it's just outside of my knowledge. How did you say, do you know what, I've run a fleet, so I'm going to create an app?
So when I started with the fleet, I turned up and there was a pile of parking tickets and a drawer full of logbooks. There was no process, no system, and it was me and a couple of people that were part-time. So immediately I thought, right, we need to streamline and we need to get processes in place. And that's always been my way of dealing with a company and going into a company and saying, right, let's make this as efficient and as paperless as possible so that everything we can access wherever we need to be, let's get this on the cloud. And actually, this was the one area that over the years, when running a fleet, you deal with the cars and then you deal with the staff, then you deal with admin. The accident side was just an area that I kind of left to the last in the list, because it was not glamorous, very tricky to kind of maintain any stability within this company to get some processes in place properly. And I thought, right, let's tackle this head on. And I spent a good couple of years learning accidents and claims while I was running the fleet, and that gave me such a good stead to be able to say, these are the manual processes of what's happening with all different fleets and all different areas and all different stakeholders. Let's make that digital.
And how did you go about that? Did you, where did you find these people? Because, you know, the app developer world is enormous. And I wouldn't know where to start finding the right people to develop something that clearly is based on your experience and a hell of a lot of drive. But finding the right people to be able to code that and make that a real thing can't be easy.
No, it's not. And I actually met the guy that built my MVP at a beach club in Gran Canaria.
As one does.
And this is the crazy thing. Everybody will say to you, I've got a friend that can build software. I know somebody that can build a product. And whenever you start this journey, there will always be people that say, we could have built that quicker and we could have built it cheaper. So you have to have conviction with who you're choosing, and you have to be confident, and you have to like give them your full trust and responsibility in building. So my MVP was built by a guy in Gran Canaria. Great. We had a lovely year. I was able to build the MVP, get it tested with some people, work out how it was going to work. That gave me a year of semi-building a product while actually canvassing the market to find out who would build the actual version one and take what we had cheaply built, very mock-up, and then make it an actual sellable product. And I stumbled across this company that I was recommended, and they built something called a technical functionality document. And that was like my Bible. And I was able to take that to lots of different software companies and get them to quote me based on this functionality document. That helped because I was able to look at the quotes, tender for that opportunity. And I actually went back to the company that built that functionality document in the beginning to build the product. So it worked out that I had a good year of testing it out, seeing what was on the market, working out pricing and building the trust with that initial company. And it has worked out brilliantly. They have been great.
Fantastic. And so first of all, Renee, you've broken the cardinal rule. I'm sorry. So early on in the don't look too worried. It's the no acronym rule. MVP for our uneducated listeners is, I mean, and they're not all uneducated, but they just might not know what an MVP is. They might not have ever developed any software or things like that. Explain to us an MVP, if you would.
So an MVP is something called a minimal viable product. So what do we need to build? Bare bones, not much functionality. It doesn't have to be pretty. In fact, it's a little bit embarrassing. And you just build it and you just get it out there and you say to people, would you buy this if it was a bit better? And they go, yes, we would. And you don't ask your friends and family because they're always going to agree and go, yes, we love it, dear. You're doing such a wonderful job. You pass it over to people that are used to apps, that are used to software. And it is gut-wrenching. You actually are putting your baby out on show and you're saying, give me the worst feedback you can give me. And then we use that and then we take that MVP and we make it into an actual product that is a sellable product based on the feedback that we get.
I'm absolutely gutted, you know, because in the EV Cafe, I'm described as the MVP and I thought that was the most valuable player. And now I realise I'm just some crappy kind of mock-up that's not very good. Well, cheers for that, guys.
Sorry, they're just waiting for version one, John.
I think we use that in marketing vice president. There we go. Yeah, that's much better. Anyway, but Renee, so the thing that strikes me is you tell me all of this and... Because, you know, look, you've had a few years in fleet management and you know, doing a sterling job of building up a company from 44 vehicles all the way up to nearly 500 or more than 500. What gave you the credentials to want to get into fleet admin? Because I know what you did before, and I'm just thinking, tell us what you did before this. And perhaps how you got into that, but also what on earth made you think of going from X to YZ and so on?
Well, I needed a job. So my career before this was weddings and the wedding industry. So I started many, many years ago as an 18-year-old in a bridal shop selling Kodak picture packages. And I used to walk past this bridal shop every day before, because I used to work at a wet window selling company. That's a standard beginning job for any 15, 16-year-old. So I used to sell windows all day, and I used to walk past a bridal shop and I used to say, I'm going to work in that bridal shop. Then there was a Saturday position for Kodak selling. So I popped in, said, this is my job. I want this. And because I'm just extremely, I'll use the word assertive, and I get bored quite easily. So I'm like, right, I don't just want to sell Kodak. I want to sell dresses and polish tiaras and do this and run your menswear department. And I was 18, and this woman, bless her, she's a very dear lifelong friend. She said, do what you like. Come in, run with it. And I had the best 7 years rearranging the shop, bringing in new designers, going around the country, buying wedding dresses at trade shows. I then became quite involved in a magazine, Wedding Ideas magazine, and they used to send me off around the world to different honeymoon destinations. And I used to write about going to Burma and Bali and Batam, all these wonderful places. And while I was doing that, I actually moved to London and decided, okay, I'm going to set up my own consultancy company for the wedding industry and travel around the country teaching girls and shops how to sell wedding dresses. But I needed a side job to help supplement my income, because London was expensive compared to Kent. So I ended up finding this 2-day-a-week job in a fleet and just absolutely loving it. It was so different to weddings. I could be me. There was no champagne for breakfast. There was no wonderful dresses. It was very roll my sleeves up, put a Prius hood up and jumpstart them at 9 o'clock in the morning because you've got free drivers coming to pick them up. Completely different. And I just loved it. I absolutely loved it. And I thought, right, this is my calling. I love the fleet world. I love dealing with guys. I love dealing with the cars. Let's run with this.
Wow. I mean, I'm slightly gobsmacked, because it just is. It's an image where you go from the typical sort of glamorous sequins and champagne kind of approach of the weddings suddenly another piece of the jigsaw has come into place for me, and we'll come onto it later in terms of that sort of writing and stuff like that. But then to jump into fleet and just feel at home. I mean, I'm the same, right? You know, people say, or, you know, nobody ever chooses fleet. And I don't think they do. I don't think anybody really chooses fleet or automotive. It sort of chooses you and sort of sucks you in. Once you're in, you're in for life. I guess the thing that stands out the most for me in this current phase, and possibly in all of the things that you've just said, is the word bravery. You have to be phenomenally brave to spend a year selling nothing, spending money, believing in yourself, building a product from MVP, and we all know what that means now, through to this wonderful product that people are going to be able to be safer, be able to deliver, you know, or be able to sort of interact in a difficult situation more easily and all of that good stuff, and we can come on to that later. But bravery, and it's that bravery that stands out for me. Where has that bravery come from? Because it's something that's forged, isn't it, in life? What has caused you to be strong in difficult situations? What things have you been through that have brought you to this place where you're brave enough to risk everything, let's be honest, on this dream and this passion?
Wow, that's a very good question, because I don't necessarily see myself as brave. I see myself as just doing what I need to do to be where I want to be. And I suppose I think everybody's had some kind of adversity in their life. And I wouldn't say I'm a dweller. I very much kind of pick myself up and move on. I definitely, when I was very young, I had cancer and I lost my eye at a year and a half old. So that for me, I think, gave me the idea that actually I could have died at two. If they hadn't found it as quickly as they did, I would have died. So in my head, I think, just go for it. Just keep on doing it. Do what you want to do. Say yes to everything and just keep moving forward. Because at the end of the day, what's the absolute worst that can happen?
Yeah, absolutely. What is the worst that can happen? And it is funny. I mean, I find as I look back at my life, and John, I'm sure you're the same, that as we look back, there are things that happened to us, really. And it wasn't so much that we made any choices in those moments about doing something, but they happened to us and we come through it somehow. And then we look back at it and we reflect on that and we think, not that I'm invincible, but I kind of look at myself as a bit of a weeble. You know, you can keep knocking me, but I'm just going to keep standing back up again. You know, it's just weebles wobble, but they don't fall down, right? That was the thing. Again, everybody's too young except me and John for this. But weebles were, anyway, Google them, everybody. Google a weeble. You'll see exactly what I'm talking about. But we kind of, and it gives us a sort of an inner confidence. John, what would, you know, because you've been there as well, haven't you?
I have, yeah. But what's really interesting is we talk to a lot of leaders, Renee, and one of the qualities that comes out time after time after time is resilience, is being able to take a knock, and it could be health, it could be work, it could be family, it could be anything. And it seems that leaders like you have this inherent ability to cope with difficulty and see it as just a hurdle that needs to be overcome, and it pushes you on to greater things. Would you agree that you are a hugely resilient person?
Definitely, and extremely well said, John, because that is exactly what I do. I validate what's happened, I reflect, and then you move forward and you say, okay, I did that well, but we could do it better, or I did that terribly and that will never happen again.
How do you not take it personally? How do you separate out the things that happen and not take it personally? You know, the cancer thing, why me? When a business thing goes wrong, why did that have to happen to me? I was almost at success. You seem to be able to just say, this isn't about me, this is about a situation. And you're very objective, it seems. You're able to say, you know, this is a something that can go in a box, I can learn from it, and then move on. And it doesn't seem to dampen your spirit.
No, because it shouldn't. Because a lot of this stuff isn't because of who I am. It, like you said earlier, you just, things happen. And things happen to good people. I'm a good person. I'm kind. I'm happy. I'm positive. I will not let anything affect that, because the moment you do, you just spiral down. And I don't have like a victim mentality. It's just not naturally within me. I am resilient and I will fight forward. And it's the only way to be for me. This is because it's my personality trait. I'm very, unemotional, probably quite surface level, which I'm fine with. And I just glide. I just love to glide and move on and move forward. And right, okay, done that. Let's keep on going.
Okay. Because this is the key thing about this podcast, is you get behind the kind of job title, you know, founder of a tech company. And we all go, ooh, but who is Renee? Who's the real person? Have you ever found something in your life that has made you go, God, that's almost too much for me to overcome?
No, because I'm here and I'm happy and I'm positive. So there has been nothing.
It's the life affirming thing, isn't it? I think that's the key here, is that you, from a very early age, grew up with knowing that you could have lost your life and that you weren't going to waste a minute of it whilst you survived. You are here and you're not going to survive, you're going to live,
yeah, and thrive. And
yeah,
I had a great childhood. We had a huge family, almost like EastEnders. Everyone lived two doors down, very mouthy, and And it was tough, though. It was like we had no money. We had a great fish and chip shop down the road, and the fat fryer Alf used to give us free chips when we were hungry. Like we had some great stories, and all of that has built who I am today. It's the fight. You have to keep fighting. You have to strive. And that has helped impact who I want to be and who I am becoming. And because I look at my life and I think I will never allow my child to live how I lived, and I will never go back to how I lived as a child. And that's a wonderful feeling, because you know that you're only ever going to be better than you were.
Yeah.
It's fascinating to me because, you know, we reflect on where we've been and how we get here. And that there are so many sort of things that other people perceive as negative. So I've had the line in my life, you know, oh, you've had it really tough, haven't you? You know, you know, I was in care and I got into all kinds of trouble and all that kind of stuff. And family didn't work perfectly. And you get that line that gets trotted out, oh, wow, you've had it really difficult. But I actually look back at that and I just go, well, actually, that made me who I am today. And I like you most of the time. I like me. And I look in the mirror, I think, I'm okay. And it's just really curious how we can all look at things so differently, but you reflect on it as your personality.
Yeah, and I think that's where a lot of it does come down to nature, not nurture. And I am naturally positive, naturally optimistic. And I do look at other people's lives and I think, I've got it good. I live in a great country. We've got great support, great networks. I'm okay. In fact, I'm better than okay.
Does that come from your parents? Was that part of your sort of upbringing that they were very positive? And so you're very positive, or are you something different?
Oh, no. they were not very positive.
So this is something that you've learned through, because you said that it's not through nurture, it's a natural thing.
Yes, I was the oldest of three children, and I feel like my mum probably had quite a tough life, and it was very hard for her to get out of that like mentality when she had us as children. And being the oldest, you take on a role of let's get things done. Because you have a responsibility, and I felt I had a responsibility to my younger brother and sister. So you almost forgo childhood and you jump straight into being a responsible teen and young adult. Mm. And that just, I enjoy that. That is my, I like being bossy. I like being assertive. I like keeping things under control. So it just worked out for me. I'm pleased I was the oldest child, and I've got two great siblings now. So,
and I guess friends must have played an important part in your life then as you grew up, because you're a very gregarious person. You're out there, you kind of big smile, you go out and you meet people, you make an effort with people. Did you have a lot of friends when you were growing up?
Yes, I did. And I was very much in the theatre circle. So do you know them really annoying kids that would sing in the corner of a corridor and wind like everybody up? Because, yeah, it was just every lesson was a chance to shine.
like Paul. So
I never shined. That was my problem. Anyway, sorry, Renee. So, come back to you.
Paul also has a theatrical background, and this is very interesting. Show-offs United. Right, okay. Sorry, Renee. Well, he might go there in a minute, but keep telling your story. Sorry.
No, so you'll find with the theatre clan, we're all very happy and joyful and high-kicking, high-top-C singing group. And it was just lovely. I didn't have any peer pressure, because I wasn't in the cool gang. I wasn't in the, oh, we need to smoke, or we need to do this, we need to truant. I was in a really lovely group of friends, and some of those friends I'm still friends with today. 20 odd years later. And so my friendship group is strong, small but strong.
And you mentioned hitting a top C. So a singer as well as an actor?
No. Karaoke, I will smash karaoke. Just not in tune.
Yeah, I think we're more in the murderer song category, me and Paul.
So top, well, actually, John, you can hold a tune. There's no question. We're not going to put it to the test right now. But John actually can hold a tune, and he's pretty good, actually, when he chooses to. And he might actually hit a top C. You and I, Renee, it sounds like we might just kind of scream loudly and call it a top C. So to John's point, John is he's no wallflower when it comes to the stage, and certainly whether or not he did it as a child or not, it doesn't matter. You put him on a stage now, and you know this, Renee, right? He comes to life. But yes, it's true. I was in the National Youth Theatre as a kid, and so went to London and acted on the West End stage, albeit very briefly. It sounds very grand. I think I had tennis balls, my liege. And that was about it. We...
I'm yeah, impressed.
Standing ovation, if you please. But it was... But these are the things, aren't they? You know, the things that form us, that make us who we are today. Who was your biggest influence as you grew up and as you, or even now, really? You know, who has been your biggest influence in life?
I think I wouldn't say I've got one key person, but I have always looked to others as influence and with admiration and thought, okay, this is who I aspire to be. And I've had many strong female people in my life, in the wedding industry, some wonderful business women, full of great, great achievers in the wedding industry and very feminine. And that helped propel me. And LinkedIn, surprisingly, has been fantastic for inspiring me. I've had an amazing experience on LinkedIn over the past couple of years. My network has grown. I get to see fantastic business people doing amazing jobs and the failures and the successes. And that is so inspiring to me that daily I can get a nugget of information and I can be connected to somebody that just wouldn't cross my path. So I look for inspiration. I thrive off of inspiration, and I still aspire to be like people that I look at daily on a social networking site, which is crazy, really.
But not only do you do the social media thing really well, Renee, you mentioned moving from Kent to London. You've become a bit of the institution in London, haven't you? You're not just any old Renee Rogers, are you?
This has to be one of my favourite things that I did last year, and it has changed my life. And so last year I became a freeman of a livery company called the Hackney Carriage Drivers. So the London city is made up of lots of different livery companies, and I'm a freeman of the Hackney Carriage Drivers. And becoming a freeman of that livery has given me the opportunity to become a freeman of the City of London. So I have the keys of the city. I can walk my sheep across London Bridge.
Always handy.
Great. I did it last year. And it connects all the wonderful things about this country. It connects my love for London, my love for king and country, trade, compliance, regulation, all the great things about business, but social and history. And I am so proud to be able to say that I am a freeman of the City of London.
That's an incredible thing to have achieved. Is it a long process? Do you have to qualify, or do you have to do something special? How do you do that?
You have to be sponsored to become a liveryman of your, like a freeman of your certain livery. And they're becoming a lot more modern now. So in the olden days, but in the medieval times, because this is when it started.
Well, when me and John were kids.
Back with the Weeble Wobbles, you would actually have very strict entry requirements, actually, to get into delivery companies. Now they're slightly more relaxed because there's a lot of philanthropy and charity involved. So in 2022, the livery companies as a whole actually donated and raised around £72 million for charities. We're a huge charity donator. So, and it's the history of London that we just don't want to die. So to be able to bring more people into the fold and make more people aware of what the livery companies are and what we actually do, it's becoming a bit more easier to understand. It's not a closed off group. So even though there are some hurdles to jump, you can get through, and it's all part of becoming part of that community. And it's very old fashioned. I love it. The tradition is there. You have a clerk, you have a beagle with a stick that beats you if you're naughty. Like, it's, I don't think he's officially allowed to do that anymore. Yeah. Come on over.
And you mentioned your royal love. Is the livery company, is that a uniformed kind of a traditional marching type organization where you go out on ceremonial parades, that kind of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's very connected to the Lord Mayor of London, not the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, but the actual Lord Mayor of London. And it's steeped in royal tradition. So Nicholas Lyons, last year's Lord Mayor, was actually one of the people at the coronation with King Charles. And he was there to help present an item. And it has very strong royal links. And I had to pledge my allegiance to king and country when I was sworn in as a freeman. And then I had to pledge my allegiance to the queen before then, but then unfortunately she died before my freedom of the city. So it has very strong royal links. And we're there to protect the city and say, no, this is who we are, this is what we do, and we're proud of that, and we're proud of our heritage and our royal family.
Amazing. Right. A good friend of mine, Sheila Mools Maxted, is also a freeman of the city. She's worked for the City of London for a number of years. And she got married to one of my best friends, Simon Maxted, hence Mools Maxted. And she was allowed to get married in the Tower Bridge. So we got married on the third story, or we didn't. I was at the wedding on the third story of the Tower Bridge. It was a super cool moment. And we got to go out onto the top of the bridge to take cool, some of the photographs and up into the belfry and into the roof and stuff. So there you go. That's one you need to keep up your sleeve, you know, just in case. Yeah. I don't know your marital status, I have to say. But, you know, maybe it's one for the future. Or you could renew your vows if that's already done. But there we go.
Or my next husband. Who knows?
Yeah. Just get another one. Yeah. Just
took a dark turn.
Who knows?
Oh, fantastic.
It's definitely something that I didn't realise was out there, but I'm so pleased I'm part of it now. And the people I get to meet, I had dinner last year in Mansion House with the Lord Mayor, and I'm sitting next to these wonderful people high up in their industry thinking, I can't believe I'm here, and I just have to have these pinch me moments. I think, I'm here with Mr. Sainsbury's. Like, this is, it's just phenomenal.
Wow.
I love it. Yeah.
You talked about Ono right at the beginning of this, and I'd like to go back to that if I can, just to understand the timeline. So you're now at the point where you've done beta testing of your app and the processes and the software. And you've been in this for a little while now, 2 or 3 years, in that kind of building up to this stage where you're at. What's the future look like for Ono? How long before companies can start to benefit from the work that you've done?
We're looking end of February, beginning of March. So the feedback, really quick. The feedback has been fantastic from the beta. It's a solid product already. There's been some wonderful suggestions for the app. Like, can you add Face ID? Can you do this? And all things that cost money, But we will take those suggestions and then work out which ones are the most beneficial, implement them, and then make them live ready for the end of February. I need to start producing revenue. And I have lots of companies ready, signed up in the background, ready to go. I just can't wait to give it to them because they're testing it out at the moment going, we want this. Can we just press play? And I'm like, not yet. Let's just, I just want it solid because it's such a, it's a serious situation. We're dealing with accident information. We're dealing with evidence at the scene of sometimes a crime, and we have to make sure that this information is processed correctly and with the correct security measures in place so that everybody is receiving that single source of truth. And I want to make sure it's properly done.
And is it something that you will only, I suppose, retail or set up to sell to people as the Ono brand, or will you white label this software solution for an insurance house, for instance, to use? How does it work?
Absolutely open to white labeling. We've built it. I love the brand Ono, and I'm very keen on keeping it impartial. So we don't link with insurers. We don't have any investment from insurers. We're very keen on keeping people's data to themselves and them being the owner of that data. And they can then share that with whoever they want. So it doesn't go directly to your insurer. You choose when and how you share that information. So even though we're more than happy to white label, and we've had people ask that, that's no problem. Building brand Ono is number one priority at this moment in time, because the more reports that keep going to all these insurers with Ono splashed across the top, we become more valuable as a company.
Mm. Mm. And what does the brand stand for? I mean, what's its values?
We are all about impartiality and facilitating that data, transparency, and we're very pro-fleet. So our core values, I always say, are we do not want to make any money from an accident. So we don't charge per accident. We don't charge to facilitate that accident information. We are just there to carry that information for you and send it to who needs to know. We do not want to make money from the accidents that people have. That's a very core value of ours.
So I suppose the obvious question is, how do you make money?
So it's a subscription as a service product, SaaS, and we charge per vehicle per month. So fleet companies come to us. We have the back end dashboard that holds a lot of valuable information for fleet owners, and that's where the value comes in. We can start giving fleets wonderful data insights. We can help prevent incidences, and you can only get that by facilitating that accident information at the roadside.
Understood. Thank you.
So this is the FNOL, right? So there's a good acronym. First notification of loss. Is that the terminology that we're talking about here?
Absolutely. And we would call it an EFNOL. So FNOL is the first notification of loss. That at the moment is usually done over the phone, or fleet drivers come into an office and it's all written down. And you can imagine being at the side of the road with a scrap of paper, a couple of notes on your phone, a couple of dodgy pictures, and then having to translate all that information into an actual valid report. It's extremely difficult. So we have electrified that process, like, so it becomes an electronic first notification of loss. And that's what we deal with. We deal with that EFNOL at the roadside, and then we push that forward. So it's malleable data. Companies can then work with it.
So, and it goes into the company as opposed to sort of going to an insurer. So you mentioned not sending it to insurers straight away, but is there a sort of a process that the company then takes that data and decides what they send through to the insurer, or can it ping to both at the same time?
So we can, building an API for certain companies or brokerages, they request APIs. We give the power to the fleet. So they can send that information instantly through to an insurance company or a brokerage. Our reports from the roadside to fleet owner take around 20 seconds to come through into their back end dashboard. So they have that information immediately. I would always suggest dealing with the driver first, making sure they're safe and calm and en route to wherever they need to be. Then they can decide what they do with that report. Will it go through to insurer, to the broker? Do we deal with it in-house? But they have that opportunity to deal with it how they want to.
It is a really solid product. And having been in the fleet industry for 20 years now, I've been in leasing companies, in manufacturers. This is a critical moment. It was a time where, you know, insurers used to take advantage of this delay in the reporting of the first notification of loss with the credit hire companies, and they would get vehicles in and it would be very expensive, and it really, you know, pushed up the value and cost of an insurance claim. But this feels like it's going to reduce that and make the whole process much more efficient.
Exactly that. If you report an accident within 24 hours, it's on average around £3,000 a claim. If you report it over 14 days, that can triple to £9,000 a claim. And fleet drivers aren't that quick to report incidences. So the average reporting time for a fleet driver is around 18 days. So we're looking at tripled claim costs immediately before we've even got into the crux of the incident. So, and we let fleets deal with all their own suppliers. So they do not need to change repair garages or credit hire companies. We just push that data through to who they already use.
Let me ask you a question about the future of Ono. Okay, you get this product up, running, doing its thing. Fabulous. I suspect that the René Rogers that we've come to know and adore is somebody who's not going to sit on their hands and say, oh, good, job done. And you talked about brand Ono. Where's it going? Once you've done this bit, what's next?
Goodness. Well, I have so many ideas. And my brain just doesn't stop. I want a virtual pop-out me at the roadside. I want virtual vehicle repair, 3D imaging of cars, and I can't keep up with my own thoughts sometimes. I have to just write it all down. Everything's there on my wish list of where I see the company going. But I think at the moment, I'm just so focused on getting a product out there and actually producing revenue so that we can take this globally. I want to be in America. I want to be in Europe. We have to go to Australia. There's so many cars. I need to get a solid product that can have global expansion. I think that is my next dream.
And is the logic to go to Europe next because it's closest, or is it English speaking world because that's probably the most easily replicated?
Absolutely, English speaking first. However, we have built the app with the underpinning to make it multilingual. So we will push for, I've got one of my staff members that lives in Cyprus. So we're already starting to look at Cypriot car hire companies and Cypriot fleets because we have those opportunities. And we just focus on the easy ins, the connections that we can get in first and that won't mind us in this early stage. Mm. And then we can move on to the bigger companies in America.
Wow. And you're somebody who's a real, you talked about role models earlier and you said that you have lots of good female role models. And I suspect people who've heard this may see René Rogers as a female role model. What do you hope they see in you as a human being and an entrepreneur? What are the qualities that you bring to the table that your daughter or my daughter or people that just happen to listen to this take away from this podcast?
You said it earlier, resilience, for sure. Go for it. If you want something, just go for it and ask the questions. Get the no's. The no's are good because at the end of the day, if you don't ask and you don't do, it's a no anyway. And really, what is the worst that can happen? Say yes, ask the questions and don't be frightened of the no's.
Okay, good advice.
And one from me, if I may, We talk a lot about sustainability and efficiency and decarbonisation. How do you see what you do? Because I know you're passionate about this. I know that this is important to you, but it's not immediately clear how Ono makes that difference. How does it, you know, impact the world of sustainability?
My route into loving the idea of electric vehicles actually started way back in 2017, when I was managing the fleet. We had probably around 250 hybrids, and we were suddenly given 30 BYDs and told, get these out, let's see how they go. And if I don't know if you've ever dealt with taxi drivers, but suddenly giving them a vehicle where they have to charge and take time out of their day and be responsible for journey times and lengths, and 90% of our drivers were using public charging, it was tough, really tough. And I suddenly realized that actually electric vehicles are here to stay, and we need to educate ourselves, and I need to educate my team, and I need to make them a positive addition to the fleet, not the, oh, and we have an electric vehicle. It had to be one of the first options. We have an electric vehicle, and this is how it's going to save you money, because taxi drivers are all about saving the money, and you then need to link the time for charging to how much they're actually going to save in the long run. And when I realised we could get 30 drivers into BYDs that didn't have a clue about electric vehicles and charging, we had to baby step them through the whole process. To then being able to say we had 150 electric vehicles on fleet within 2 years, and we had drivers that were used 90% public charging, doing 150 to 200 miles a day, I thought, there is a place for these vehicles in society. If we can get taxi drivers using these, doing that high mileage with no comfort of a home charger, then anybody can drive an electric vehicle, without a doubt. And that has followed through into building Ono, because I can now see the difference in insurance costs between an ICE vehicle and an electric vehicle. I can analyze the accident ratios. We can look at parts and what kind of parts we need to have a really good secondhand market for, because they're expensive to fix. And so that's why you tend to go for a hybrid or a normal ICE car, because easy to get secondhand parts and the insurance is cheaper. However, I will have valid data insights in a year's time that will show actually these are the areas we need to focus on so that fleets can adopt electric vehicles efficiently and make sure their asset is working for them in the most reliable way and making the money and making sure it's on the road, and that we have a great collaboration of sustainable companies to keep these vehicles moving and to keep fleets moving, especially taxi companies, because they're 24 hours a day. There's no downtime. We cannot afford downtime. And that's where I hope Ono will help provide those data insights to help these fleets transition into electric quicker and more relaxed and a bit more comfortable. And we can prove, we can give the stats to prove that actually you can adopt these vehicles. It's not frightening. We can go for it.
But I think that's really important, because right up front, we want data. We want insight, because a lot of myths out there, you know, rumors that, you know, electric cars are more expensive to repair, and we know that that is true to some degree. But here you are saying, actually, if we can get that EFNOL, that first notification of loss, or the EFNOL, submitted quickly, then we can reduce that cost and make life better for the insurer to get things replaced more quickly, and we can see that whole process come down and see how many less accidents you're likely to have in an electric vehicle, because they are easier to drive and inherently safer because of the amount of tech that's on them. So it sounds like that insight is going to be a real critical piece going forward.
Definitely. And I always felt in my fleet that we were having a lot of electric vehicle accidents, but actually when you drill down the liability, I found out that my drivers were actually having non-fault accidents because they were more courteous. They were safer drivers. They were driving slower. So even though they still had accidents, their liability was, it wasn't their fault as an accident. So that in essence didn't impact my bottom line as much as my ICE drivers.
That's interesting. So one final thing, Renee, is you are a new business that's about to smash the market. What's the biggest piece of help or support that you need to be able to deliver on your potential?
It's all about spreading the word for me. It's about people knowing what we do, that we're not a claims management company, that we are just a data facilitator, and we're there to help streamline your already paper processes. We're there to help streamline that. And it's a spreading the word, the networking, and people giving me little shout outs now and then. That's what it's about. And yeah, the support is needed, without a doubt.
Okay, well, if you need to get in touch with Renee, what's the best way of doing that?
LinkedIn, without a doubt. Find me on LinkedIn, Renee Rogers. Type in "oh no" anywhere, because my CEO guy should be doing some serious work on that. And find me, come and chat to me. I will talk to anybody. I will demo the system, or I'll just get on a Zoom and we can have a cup of tea.
Proof positive that Renee will talk to anyone is she appeared on the EV Cafe Takeaway.
Talking to me and John.
It's been a pleasure. Renee, I've really enjoyed myself.
Well, fabulous. And just before you go, I just wanted to kind of pick up on LinkedIn particularly. It's almost a conversation in itself with you, because you just smash LinkedIn. Every time you go on there, the engagement that you get is incredible. You have a very creative mind. Have you thought about a career in marketing as well as tech?
Oh, I can't do anything else, Paul. I'm already up to here with stuff that I need to do. No marketing. I'm just me. I'm unashamedly me. And I say what I want. I say how I feel. And I share my journey. And if you're authentic, and it feels like such a naff word to be authentic, but believe me, it does work. Be you and let people see you. Warts and all.
Well, there aren't very many of those, Renee. That's all I can say. You are quite simply fantastic. Thank you so much for spending some time with us. Really appreciate that. Paul, any last thoughts?
Well, I don't think we could have said it better, but that authenticity that just comes across in every moment of our time with you, Renee, it has been a real joy. We can clearly see that this business, Ono, is going to make a tremendous difference to fleets and to drivers. Driver well-being is something that's really important to us at the EV Cafe, that mental health thing. And if we can take one trauma out of people's day, then that is really brilliant news. And this definitely does that. So nobody is going to be going, "oh no," because they have "oh no" to help them along the way. Renee, it has been a privilege and a pleasure, and we've had a lot of fun, really insightful, so much more that we could do and say. But for now, thank you so much. Everybody, please check out Ono's website, connect with Renee on LinkedIn. You won't regret it. It's always fun and always interesting and always insightful and inspirational. So check out Renee, check out the evcafe.org to see more podcasts just like this. Finally, thanks ever so much for listening, and have a great day, everyone.